We're going to go to the third reading. Picking up the Shlishi. The subject for today is going to be the ultimate caregiver. Melech is the ultimate caregiver, as we will see. Chapter 7, verse 17. Vayihi hamabul. So the flood was arborim yoim 40 days al haaretz, on the face of earth. Vayirbu hamayim, the waters increased. Vayisu es hateva, it lifted that big barge full of animals and a few people. Vayirbu me'ed, pardon, vatorim me'al haaretz, it lifted off from the ground. So a couple of things have to be understood over here. It says in the Torah, "Vayisu es hateva," that the waters carried the barge, the ark. And then it says, "Vatorim me'al haaretz," and it says lifted it off the ground. So clearly, first there had to be a groundswell of water, because this was a very heavy boat, a very heavy barge. And only after there was an enormous groundswell, only then did it actually, so to speak, lift forth. So Rashi says, "Mushkas hoisa b'mayim achas esrei amah." This barge was actually submerged 11 amot, was beneath sea level. So it's like every boat dips into the sea. This was a full 11 amot submerged. Kisfinatuna, like any loaded watercraft. Meshukas miktsas b'mayim. Some of it ends up being submerged in the water. The verses that we're going to be studying will prove to us how deeply it was submerged in the water. We'll see that because we'll see how high the water went. All right, so that's on a literal level. That's the business with the barge being submerged. But here's a question which Rashi doesn't address, and when you hear the answer, you'll know why. The mabul. When you talk about the timeline for the mabul, what's the usual statement? Mabul was for
40 days
and 40 nights. What does the pasuk say here? Verse 17. Vayihi hamabul.
40 days.
Arboim yoim, 40 days. But what happened earlier? We had 40 days and 40 nights. So the psik tezutusa says this, don't think like it rained during the day and it's done. It was always raining. It didn't stop raining. During the day and during the night. And the Ibn Ezra says, earlier when we spoke about the rainfall, the rain fell for yom v'layla, day and night. Here, we're just trying to talk about a period of time. 40 days is not any shorter than 40 days and 40 nights. So when you talk about a period of time, you don't have to specify that it's 40 days and 40 nights, because obviously you're talking about a period of time that begins here and ends here. You're talking about the span of 40 days. Obviously, it would include the nights.
Something in the Haggadah where it says about days and nights, because it's at night. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's about mentioning the Shema. It says mention the Shema. The question has to mention during the day or has to mention during the night. Yeah, that's a different story. That's the question of when should I be doing something, during the daytime hours or during the night hours. But here we're not talking about when I should be doing something. We're talking about a period of time. So when you talk about what happened, water fell. When did it fall? 40 days and 40 nights. It was a consecutive period of time. There were no breaks in between. Zugizunt. Verse 18, what happens? So the water's on the earth, and it's raining. And the teva lifts up. The teva says, Vayigbiru hamayim, the waters continue to gather strength. Vayirbu ma'id, they were increased in tremendous, tremendous amount, volume of water, al haaretz. So in verse 17, the teva lifts off the ground. The teva is floatworthy. In verse 18, the voyage begins. And we believe that the voyage ends in Turkey, in Kurdistan, in Mount Ararat. And actually, there's a group of Christian archaeologists who are pretty sure they found the teva, or the remnants. Yeah, it's pretty compelling stuff, and Turkey doesn't let them go there anymore because of the PKK. But in all likelihood, that is the teva. So Noach lives in Mesopotamia, which is more like southern Iraq. And this ends up in Kurdistan, in eastern Turkey, northeastern Turkey. So the Teva had to travel a little, even though this was not a typical boat, because the usual boat is built for traveling, and the Teva was not built for traveling. It was a survival barge, survival craft.
Lifecraft.
It was a gigantic life raft. But nonetheless, the waters were so intense that even though it was square and it didn't have sharp edges and it didn't have sails and it didn't have a motor, so to speak, or oars, it nonetheless, so to speak, set sail. It started to move. By Yigbru Hamayim, the waters became increasingly gathered strength. So Rashi says this happened even after the rain finished. The waters continued to rage, me'alehen, from themselves. There was no foreign power or something that was buffeting the water, some wind or some additional rainfall. But the waters themselves, just such a volume of water, the water raged. So there was raging waters. And these raging waters, Ramban tells us that the word of vayigbru is a permutation of gevura. And here, gevura doesn't mean so much raging as much, he says, as it means ribui. It was an enormous amount. Enormous amount, he says. Because the water, the volume was so overwhelming, so much water, that it was like, that's the nature of water. When you have enormous amount of water, the water begins to gather strength. So the water gathers strength. It was like a ferocious sea. Now then it says vayigbru hamayim, and then it says vayirbu. So why does it say vayigbru, which comes to the word gevura, as Ramban says, and then it's after vayirbu, comes to the word ribui, or a lot. Why does it say them both? So Radak says that vayirbu speaks about the volume. Vayigbru speaks about the energy in the water. So vayigbru was intense, churning waters. How much was it? A lot of water. Ribui. So this water, it was so much of it that it actually just started to, the Teva started to move along, says the Malbim. But once it started moving, it was like a groundswell of water. The Malbim was just like the Teva was not really moving in a very graceful way. It's just like
drifting.
But drifting with such force that it ended up going wherever it went. The waters, Rashi says, even more, the Teva says, even increased even more a lot. It covered the highest mountains in the region, which were under the face of earth. I should point out to you that according to tradition, we believe the Mabul was only in the eastern hemisphere, not in the western hemisphere. We believe that the western hemisphere was not yet populated. Human population, human beings arriving to the western hemisphere is only post-Mabul. And interestingly, we'll learn later that most of the Mabul waters, Rashi already mentioned it before, eventually receded in Shinar. Shinar is like southern Iraq, Kuwait, Arabia. That's where the waters receded. And you're going to hear now what happens to the bodies or the remains of all of life. Basically, it liquefies. So there's this very compelling theory that the reason there's so much oil to be found in Iraq and Kuwait and in Arabia is because this is the remnants of the people and animals, that they got liquefied. It's true, Israel found some natural gas, but natural gas is not oil, and they found it beneath the sea. So this is, like, it's a strange thing. Why not in Israel? Because it says that it was only in Shinar. That's what it says. It says that's where everything kind of sank. All the waste sank, and the waste seeped into the ground. And here we are, 5,000 years later, and yeah, the oil is available. It's a Mabul left over, and that's why in Eretz Yisrael there's no oil, or no large amounts of oil. It's a funny thing. It's like that part of the world has oil everywhere but Israel. Like, why?
But in the States, there's oil in other places.
Yeah.
But there was no Mabul.
The oil, the way it's found in the Middle East, is not found anywhere else.
The why? Concentration.
Because the concentration is enormous. Second of all, there's no drilling necessary. Canada, they do fracking. If they go through shale, it's like it costs $70 or something like that to extract the barrel. In Kuwait, it costs like $5, pennies. It's a joke. You stick a pole in the ground and you get the oil coming out. So it's an unnatural phenomenon. Anyway, just a compelling theory. You don't have to like it, but it's not the focus of today's class. Huh?
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Chamesha Se'ama, the Torah says now that this waters, which was so intense and swelling and covering all the highest mountains, eventually went 15 amos higher than the highest of mountains. Gavru Hamoyim, all the mountains were covered over. Rashi says, 15 amot, l'mayla shel goyva kol ha'harim. 15 amot, we're not talking about the lowlands, we're talking about even the highest, the summit. It was 15 amot higher than that. La'acha shehoshvu p'nei amoyim l'rashi ha'harim. Once you could see nothing on planet Earth, all of planet Earth was submerged, then another 15 amot higher it went. Self-understood, by the way, there was tsunamis, massive tsunamis, and there was an enormous amount of eruption of waters from beneath, besides all the rain. This was like a water from all sides. So what happens? Vayigvar kol basar, all flesh expires. Haremis alor, it's the flesh that crawls upon the earth. Ve'if, birds. Uva behema, animals. Uva chaya, beasts. Uva chol asheretz, asheretz alor, it's every creeping crawler on the ground. Ve'chol ha'odom, and all of the people. So we got a very interesting list over here. So first of all, why does it say Yigva kol basar only in verse 21, after verse 20? And the answer is because there was lots of people who sought cover in the high ground. In fact, do you know that in the terrible tsunami that was in the Far East, not a single animal carcass was found? Not a single animal carcass.
They all went to high ground.
They all went to high ground. The animals had some kind of premonition. There's a story I read in the paper at the Times of an elephant who had been chained in the backyard, who had moaned for days and eventually broke loose, dragging the tree it was chained to, running with the tree. So that's the natural thing to do. And of course, when people see this kind of waters come, what are they going to do? Migrate to the hills. So only after we hear of the waters covering the highest areas, that's when we can say Vayiva Kol Basar, because as long as you didn't get to the top of the mountains, there was lots of Basar who were still surviving. Animals for sure took refuge. Lots of people took refuge over there. What does the word Gevia mean? Why does it have a Yamas? So Ibn Ezra says that Gevia indicates instantaneous, very, very quick death. It was not a long, drawn-out process. And this kind of speaks to the idea of there was the sulfurization. It wasn't just water. But there was a chemical element to the Mabul too. Now, why do we have this order? First Oif, then Behema, then Chaya, then Sheretz. So the Malbim says that's how they died. The birds are the weakest. Can't fly forever. There's nowhere to land. The birds are very weak consistency. They just collapsed. The Behema, strong like a Behema. No, a Behema. You got a little more keichas. The Chaya is even stronger, the wild beast. And then, eventually, all of the little creepy crawlers who had hidden in the crevices and cracks, which is inundated, flooded. And then it says, interestingly, a person comes at the end. Why? Doc says, because people are smart. People figure out how to survive. Animals have survival instinct. We actually have brains to figure out how to survive. Maybe people try to create a watercraft. Maybe they created floating devices. People, because that's what people are. People are very smart animals. So because the people are smart, it took, till all the people died, took more time. But eventually, everybody died. All right. Everybody died. Obviously, if everybody died, they're being punished. If they're being punished, they must have done something wrong. Could they have done something wrong if they weren't warned before? Could you hold somebody culpable if they're not warned? No. So when were they warned? So the Medrash Rabba says they got six mitzvahs through admonition. They know exactly what was going on. That's the proof that there had to be mitzvahs given by Hashem. How could Hashem exact payment if he never gave mitzvahs? Which brings us to verse 22. The Torah continues to talk about this mass genocidal effect of the flood. Koil asher nishmas ruach chayim be'apav, anything that had a breath of life in its nostrils. Mikoil asher becharova, everything on dry land, mesu died. Rashi says, what is the meaning of nishmas ruach chayim? He says, nishmas chayim and ruach chayim are not two different things. Nishmas ruach chayim is one thing. This is the neshama shall call ruach chayim, the soul of every living thing. So the soul of every living thing separated from the bodily reality. Asher becharava, which was on dry land, v'lo dogim, not the fish. The fish did not die. The fish, that's a natural habitat. Even though there was a sulfuric element to the flood, the fish were not harmed. They knew how to swim deeper and escape from that. Nothing happened to them. And the Torah now describes the absolute total devastation. Vayimach eskol hayukum asher al pnei adama. Entirety of civilization. everything was literally wiped off the face of the earth. Everything.
Except the fish.
Face of the earth, meaning there, that was on dry land.
Wasn't there some type of heat or wasn't the water hot?
Yeah.
Boiling?
Yeah.
And the fish were able to survive
that? Not all the water was boiling. The fish probably went into the Atlantic, in the Mediterranean, went into the ocean. You know how cold it gets? You go like 10 miles, 15 miles beneath sea level. So the fish, they survive, but who died? Me'adam, from the person, ad behema, to the animal. Ademus, to the creepy crawler. Ve'ifashamayim. Interesting, here the list gets reversed. Vayimachu, here the birds come last. Vayimachu min ha'aretz, they get wiped off the face of the earth. Vayishar, ach, noyach v'asharite b'teva. All of life is destroyed. The only sign of life, planet Earth, is found in that little floating barge. Everything is destroyed. Everything. So before we get to Noach and talk about this idea of Ach Noach, what does it mean Vayimach? Vayimach means it was wiped out. Loshen Vayifel. This was like it was a God was actively wiping out all of life. Ve'eini Loshen Vayifel. It's not what happened. Vahu Megzeres Vayifen Vayiven. This is from the same grammar, same tense. As he turned, he built. Kol teva shasefa hei, any word which ends with a hei, bono, macha, kono, building, wiping, acquiring. Kishonesin vav yud bereisha. When you put a vav and a yud in front of it, nakud bechirik tachas a yud, then it would be vowelized as such, vayiven. So bono, vayiven, he built. Macha, vayimach. Kono, vayiken. Okay, that's the rule. Now, why does the order get reversed here? Well, before we get to the order, let's ask another question. What's Kol Hayikum? First it says Kol Hayikum, then it says Kol Achaya, Behema, person, Sheretz, Oif. What's Kol Hayikum? Kol Hayikum is all of life. He just described all of life. So Rabbeinu Bachaya says that we're talking here about trees. We're talking here about plant life. Vegetation was stripped from the face of the earth. The earth was literally restored to its original, almost primordial state, covered in water.
Scrubbed down into the earth for a few feet.
Scrubbed down into the earth. The entire level, entire layer was peeled off the face of the earth. Incidentally, with regard to the fish that didn't die, so there's a special bracha that they got on the fifth day. It says, Hashem bless the fish. Hashem bless them. They should be multiplied. So it says that bracha, Rabbeinu Bachaya says, stood in their stead. That bracha, so that's. And Ramban says the word vayimach doesn't just mean they died. Vayimach means that they liquefied, they sulfurized, which goes back to the oil theory. Nothing was left. So why does it say person, the person first over here? So the Malbim says because human beings are smart, but not that strong. We don't have the stamina that animals have. You don't call it manpower, call it horsepower. Thank you. So therefore, even though human beings are usually smart enough to survive, we don't have the koyach of an ox, of a lion. We don't have. So therefore, realistically speaking, once the water is inundated and overwhelmed, people died first. People died very quickly. Excuse me. So who's left? Ach Noach. Ach Noach. Rashi says, Ach Noach. Levad Noach. And Noach and those are with him. Zeh pshutei. So the little word Ach means Levad. Alone. Only Noach. However, that's a funny way to say it. It should say Levad Noach. Or Rak Noach. What's Ach? So therefore Rashi feels compelled to introduce a Medrash Agadah. He says that Ach is coming to exclude. It's coming to be very specific. Ach Noach. What's Ach Noach? Ach Noach is that Noach's life was diminished. Noach was not as alive as when he started this process. He was in very good health. He's a very strong man. But when he went through this procedure, this caretaker responsibility, it took a tremendous amount of koyach exacted a huge toll from him. That Noach was, the word ach then is a permutation for the word goineach. Goineach means that he was constantly sighing out of pain. He was groaning.
Barely Noach. He was there, but diminished. Like
yeah, you could say. You could say that. You could say he was barely there.
Well, why didn't you swipe him?
One second. He's goineach. He's always groaning in pain. The choyeh dam, he's actually coughing blood. Mitoyrach habehemes v'achayis, from the enormous load of the animals, that the burden that was upon him. So the obvious question is, if Noach had such a burden, to the point that he was experiencing a full meltdown, where were his sons? What kind of behemoths are they? Are your father's collapsing, and they were busy watching The Simpsons?
They've been on a long time.
Yeah. It's right here in the Bible.
Setting records.
Seriously, like, what's going on there? So therefore, Rashi adds another Yeshayim. Why Noach specifically? Yeshayim wasn't from the burden of the work. Burden of work. Everybody would be under the burden of work. I'm sure his wife helped. I'm sure his daughters-in-law. Everybody was working.
What else?
But Noach was the caretaker. He was the one responsible. So what happened was, Yeshayim, Ichar Mezoneis La'ari. He once showed up late with lunch for the lion. V'Yikishay. And the lion smacked him around. He was really angry at him. Show up late. I'm hungry. But all of them are, and about this it is written in the book of Proverbs and Mishlei, Hein tzaddik ba'aretz yeshulam, that Hashem repays the sins of a tzaddik in this world, so that when he comes to Elam Haba, there's no issues. Straight passage. All right. So we have this business of Ach Noach. Noach is, he's the one who got beat up. Right? First thing is Ach Noach, only Noach. But the language is not really explained. You can fit it, but doesn't give us clarity on the syntax. So we have a Medrash Agoda, the pressure, like you say, was barely alive, barely functioning. But where's everybody else? So therefore it boils down to, you the man. He's the caretaker, he's responsible, and because he's responsible, that's why the lion beat him up. All right, what can we learn from this? So Noach, the Rebbe said, is the ultimate caretaker. This sicha, this is an excerpt of an edited sicha, but I know the background to the sicha. There was a certain shliach, who's no longer with us in this physical world, passed on, that he was in a place, a very harsh place, a very difficult place, and he couldn't hack it. It's not for anybody to judge him. He couldn't hack it. He came home. He was the first shliach ever came home. And the Rebbe was very unhappy. And the Rebbe spoke of sicha that Shabbos, Parshas Noach. And in the sicha, the Rebbe spoke about the meaning of being a caretaker, how to take responsibility, and that we're not in the business of coming home. We don't give up. My father-in-law told me that he was at the Fabregan, and he remembers the Rebbe almost like screaming, "You have a headache?" The Rebbe saying in Yiddish, "Then take an aspirin. You don't leave. You don't. What is this leaving?" This is what the Rebbe says.
Did you go back?
No, went somewhere else in the end. Mepirushim elu yesh lilmeid hara b'avaydus Hashem. From these pirushim, we can learn a wonderful lesson in the service of Hashem. Kasher ha'odom esasek v'haspokas mazen ruchni la'anoshim p'chusi erich. Let's say you're like a noyach. I'm sorry, page kuf chof tes. Simen tes zayin, chapter 16. So, let's take this out of its literal context, because obviously if you talk about it on a literal level, then it's actually Noach, but there's only one Noach in history, and only one flood, and only one teva, and only one time all the animals have to be fed. Okay, fine. Let's take it a notch down. Not from its literal iteration, let's put it into its metaphoric or figurative iteration. So there could be a person that has a job, and his job is to provide food. But who's he providing food? For nourishment. Nourishment is what keeps people alive. So let's talk about this on a spiritual level. Your job is to provide spiritual nourishment. And who are you providing nourishment for? For behemoths and chayas, for animals and beasts, which could be a euphemism. That could be people who are very low people, low-class people, people who behave like animals. Anoshim sheheim b'bchines behemoths v'chayas b'yachas l'dargase. Not that you're any better, but whatever. You live a more virtuous life. And these people live a life that's devoid of virtue. Uncivilized, uncouth, animalistic, barbarian people. And that's your job. That's, you're the zookeeper. Your job is to provide everybody with food. And it's really hard. It's really hard. You're confronted with all kinds of difficulties. So what do you do? So the Rebbe, Allah, Lulmid bin Noach. Noach is the ultimate caretaker, caregiver. You learn from Noach. What did Noach do? Jump off the boat. Shakiyim eslichusei b'chol lamatzavim. He didn't say, I give up. I quit. He fulfilled his mission. Hashem gave him a mission. That's it. You got a mission? You can't do anything about it. V'tarach l'sapek mezenis l'behemis l'chayas. He just kept trying to do his job. He toiled. Toiled to the point. He was in pain. He was racked with pain. He was coughing blood. You don't think maybe enough already? No. There's a mission. You have a mission? You can't stop your mission. I had a great uncle of Hashem. His name was Nissen Pinson. And he was one of the early shluchim. So a Russian Holocaust survivor. And the Rebbe sent him off first to Morocco and ended up in Tunis. Tunisia. Not an easy assignment. And then there was life, he had a stroke. Second stroke. And my grandmother said to him, Nissen, like enough already. And he said, when the Rebbe who sent me will tell me to come home, that's when I come home. And he never really left. Till the end of his life. He never, he's in terrible, frail health, never left. His wife still goes back all the time now. She's a very old lady, she's in her 90s. She still goes back to Tunis. Why? You have a job to do. You don't run away from your job. You got a mandate? You got a mission? You got to carry out your mission? Now here's the catch. So a person says, really? So all this is demanded of me, and everybody has such high expectations, and I'm supposed to work till the point of physical, literal, actual exhaustion, until I'm coughing blood, until I'm collapsing, until I'm plotzing. So you say, okay, then everybody, let everybody else pony up too. Let them cough blood. Let them all, let their kishkas come out too. Rebbe says, Yachadim Zeis, along with this, you have to remember, Sherak la'atzmer eshoi la'atzev drishas machmir selu. You can only make those demands of yourself. You can't make those demands of those around you. V'nigeyele elish aleim u'mashpia, the people that you're trying to help, the mouths you're feeding, tzarechu l'sapik kol machseirim b'shleimus. You got to give them everything they need. Yachad Zeis leimdim, as we learn from the second Pirush of Rashi. What happened? Shenayach nena, shenayach poor Nayach was punished by the lion. What did he do? Yisacher agosha samzenis l'aryeh. He came late with the lion's lunch. He's a lion, you behemoth. I'm coughing. I'm plotzing. My kishkas are melting. I'm coughing. I'm blood. I'm in so much pain. You go hungry for a few hours. You have to be such a beast. Lions, I know what you're talking about. I need lunch now. And the lion wants lunch now. Letzorcha azulas. Yesh, lahakmid lidig, bitsuru mishlemes. When it comes to somebody else, those you're providing for, you have to be provided for 100%. Laloi machzav ikiv. No diminishment whatsoever. The services have to be on top, over the top. B'yachas la'atzmecha. With regard to yourself, tzarachat la'vata la'mesis, you have to be ready to forgo any luxury, anything which is unnecessary, meaning beyond survival. V'afila advar machrechem, even things which are basic staples. It's like, no. You're ready to make the sacrifice. That's for yourself. When it comes to others, you have to provide them all the needs, everything they're missing, all their needs, in absolute perfection. So Noach is the ultimate caregiver. And it's from Noach, who had this very difficult and challenging mission, that all of us are supposed to learn about our own missions, our own sacrifices. The truth is that every parent does this. Which mother doesn't do this? Which mother doesn't lose everything? Lose her health, lose her figure, lose her life. Just take care of this little baby, this snarly little creep who doesn't be quiet for 1 second. Right? Good question. It's my baby. That's what the Rebbe said. That's how you have to take your mission. You got a mission? You got to help you? It's your baby. He's crying and fills diapers. He's a baby. What do you want him to do? Clean the diapers. You do your part. And you make sure that the job gets done. L'chaim.